Okay, Acts chapter number 19 is where you want to go. And we're actually going to go back to verse 23. We did this last week, but I want to hit it again because it sets the stage for tonight. Remember that Paul had been at the city of Ephesus for a couple years. By the time we're done with all this, he'll have been there about 3 years, three calendar years. So Ephesus is right here. It's on the southwest coast of the Asia province. That's the pink right here for the Roman Empire. And it's kind of the capital city for Asia province. That's why he's there. He wants to be able to get the gospel settled here and spread out into the province. And that's how the seven churches of Asia got all of the gospel into them at this time period. And when we were finishing up last week, we had been talking about the idea that he was already making plans for the future. This was his plan, and it's recorded in 1 Corinthians. He was going to work his way up past Troas, then he was going to go up here into Macedonia. This is that area that had Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea in it, places that he'd been on the previous missionary journey. And then he would eventually work his way down to Corinth and visit them. He wanted to see how things were going there. Then he said, eventually, I want to go to Rome, which is over here in Italy. But he told them, I'm going to stick around in Ephesus until Pentecost, which is the end of spring, beginning of summer. Because, he said, I've got an open door here. Everything was looking good. Everything was going really well. So he wanted to do as much as he could there before he took off on this next part of his journey. Well, all that got kicked in the head not too long after he wrote 1 Corinthians because of this, verse 23. About that time, there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way. Now, that's the Jewish way of talking about Christianity, about the church. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who had made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. And these he gathered together with the workmen of similar trades and said, men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. Not only is there danger that this trade of ours fall into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she whom all of Asia and the world worship would even be dethroned from her magnificence. So this guy, he's kind of like the head of the tradesmen guild, apparently, in Ephesus. And Ephesus is the home of one of the seven wonders of the world, which is the temple to the goddess Artemis. She was the twin sister in mythology of Apollo. And both Apollo and Artemis were thought of as huntsmen. They're always posed, you know, they're seen with bows and arrows. She is seen with hunting dogs in a lot of the stuff that they have. But for some reason, she is very much attached to the Ephesus area in worship. It goes back several hundred years before this story. That's back when the temple was first built. The guess is, and I think it makes reasonable sense, is that at some point several centuries earlier, there was this meteorite that falls out of the sky and impacts just outside of Ephesus. And when the locals went there to see what had happened. They found the remnants of the meteorite in the bottom of the crater, and it was probably vaguely humanoid in form, and it probably had little bubbles on it from, you know, superheating and things like that. And for some reason, they connected it with Artemis. And so they built a great big temple there, and they put that image probably somewhere in the temple, in a safe place. But then they start making all sorts of other images of her. And these images almost always include these little egg-like features. At first, when archaeologists saw some of these images, they thought that it was representing her having like hundreds of breasts. And so they said, she's the many-breasted god. But later they came to the conclusion, no, those are not breasts. It's actually part of her outfit. And the way that they found that out is because in the ruins around this area, they found these little egg-shaped, amber-colored globs of some sort of glass, I think. And they found enough of them that they figured out, well, these used to be the decorations put on the idol.
And they amber?
They were amber colored, but I don't remember if they actually were amber. They might have been glass. That is now what they think was actually being represented, is that this decoration that she was wearing. I actually think it goes back to the meteorite with all the bubbles from the superheating. Anyway, as is almost always the case, if you've got something really big in your area that is world-renowned, you get a lot of tourists. And this great big temple that they built had tourists streaming to it all the time, from all over the known world. And when tourists come, especially religious tourists, they always want to take souvenirs home. And the souvenirs are usually something to do with what you came and saw, such as the building, the temple of Artemis, or maybe her little image. And it would depend on what your financial ability was, how much money you were willing to spend for these things. And so these guys are in the trade of making images for all economic classes to take home with them, these tourists, whenever they come to visit the temple. And maybe some of the other tradesmen that are here might be people that make pottery, because one of the things they like to do in the ancient world was make pottery and then put images on it. In fact, I think the image that I showed you last week of Apollo and Artemis was a pot with a painting on it. And so this guy gets together all the tradespeople that have had their bottom lines cut into by the preaching of Jesus Christ as the resurrected Savior. Because they would be right. Paul would have been saying, look, idols can't talk, they can't walk, they don't make themselves, they don't feed themselves, they don't even eat. So they're not really gods, they're just images. And instead, I want to talk to you about the real God that made everything. He doesn't have to have an image of him anywhere, because he's the real God. No one's ever really seen him as he is. And so he would have been preaching that sort of stuff in connection with Jesus being the Son of God, come to this world to die for sin, rise again, and he's coming back again later. And evidently, he has made such an impact on this part of the world that people are not coming to Ephesus to the Artemis temple as much anymore. And since they're not coming to the temple, they're not buying souvenirs. They're not staying in the local hotels, or whatever passes for hotels at that time. They're not staying and eating at the restaurants in the area. And so this is a big economic hit to the region, and that makes these guys mad. And they let their anger be demonstrated as defending their goddess. And you can see that in the next verse, verse 28. When they heard this, they were filled with rage, and they began crying out, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" So they've got a big religious, spontaneous get-together. Probably starts somewhere near the temple area, but eventually it makes its way to the theater. And the reason it gets to the theater is because this is a city that was originally started by Greeks, even though it's part of the Roman Empire now. And democracy was part of Greek culture. And in democracy, all citizens gather from time to time in a public place to take votes on policies. In fact, a lot of the words that we use come from the Greek language related to this. Politics is related to the word for city, polis. Police is related to the word polis, city. And policy is related to the word for city. So all of this government is hinged on people getting together and talking back and forth about it and then taking votes. And more than likely, the place where they went to have their public meetings, their city meetings, was this theater where 25,000 seats were available. Now, were there that many citizens? Probably not. But there were certainly non-citizens that would be interested in what was being done here. And so, verse 29 says, "The city was filled with confusion. They rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia." So they can't find Paul, for whatever reason, but they sure find the guys he's traveling with, and they drag them in there to bring charges against them. What would be the charges? Blasphemy of the goddess. That would probably be the charge. And causing economic free fall would probably be related as well. All right, so any questions, comments? I know some of this was review from last week. Yeah, Rita.
Now, this idea of the Roman of gods and goddesses, did that originate with Rome and then move on?
Yeah, okay, question is, does this thing with the gods and goddesses originate with Rome? No, it doesn't. And it didn't originate with the Greeks either. See, the Romans and the Greeks did have similar gods. They just didn't have names for them. What it gets tracked back to is Mesopotamia, off our map here. The land between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. The place that we think of as Iraq and Iran, some of northern Syria as well. A lot of the gods and goddesses kind of got their start there. Way back, probably just in the post-flood era. Because you remember, after the flood, a couple hundred years after the flood, some of those guys ended up going to a place called the Plain of Sinar or Shinar, and they came up with this grand idea of building a great big tower to the sky. That probably was in relationship to a lot of this god-goddess stuff that was getting started. More than likely, just my opinion, a lot of manipulation by the fallen angels.
So was there a lot of debauchery going on with Artemis?
Was there a lot of what?
Debauchery.
Debauchery? Not as much with Artemis, no. Artemis was actually kind of the goddess of virtue, and she was the goddess of strong womanhood, and protector of families. There are a lot of aspects of her that we would probably look and go, yeah, that sounds like good ideas. But no, she wasn't like the party goddess. That would be Bacchus that comes up with the Greeks later. He was the god of wine and partying. That's why you even hear about Bacchanalian feasts, which are like drunken things. That comes from his name. So, all right, so anything else before we see how this riot goes?
So there were not gods and goddesses prior to the flood that we're aware of?
Well, there probably were some of that idea of gods and goddesses before the flood. Again, I would think because of the messing around of fallen angels. But remember, in Genesis chapter 6, it talks about how some of the fallen angels were monkeying around with the genetic code of humanity, using women. And then from that came the men of renown. And the way it's kind of phrased there, it's almost like you're talking about some of the gods and goddess stories right there. And we know that after the flood, the average length of life started going down, but they were still living hundreds and hundreds of years. And so for some of the people that were born later, meeting some of these people that were born not too long after the flood and they were still alive, some of those people would have been thought of as like gods and goddesses. They might have also been larger in body, because some of it talks about them being giants, and largeness of body got attached to that word pretty early on. Although the word itself is Greek. It's gigantes, and it actually means born of the earth. And it's a reference in Greek mythology to the idea that certain god figures had sex with human women and bore kids on the earth.
Demigods.
Yeah, like Hercules. Yep.
And did they have gods and goddesses that were like half and half things?
Animals, like some who were part animal and part human.
Well, and then like the centaur and stuff.
Yes, a lot of that stuff of animal, human sort of looking gods and goddesses, or demigods, half gods is what demigod means. Yeah, that all starts popping up throughout history. Like Pan, for example. Mm-hmm. Pan was the god of the open field. I don't remember if he was for the Greeks, I'm pretty sure. But the lower part of his body was that of a wild goat. And the upper part of his body was humanoid. Except he might have had little horns. But all that stuff apparently starts popping after the flood and beyond, until finally it starts settling down where they've got things like this. They know stories about their gods and goddesses and how they interact with each other, and they're ready to get mad if you say nasty things about their god or goddess. And so that's what they're gathering at the theater for, is to bring up a complaint against these troublemakers that are cutting into the bottom line of the economy of Ephesus and Asia, related to the worship of Artemis at the great temple of Artemis, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. All right, so verse 30 says, when Paul wanted to go into the assembly, you see that word assembly there? That's the people. That's the word for people getting together for government action, democratic action. In fact, the word democratic, that's Greek. Demo means people. Kratic means rule. And this word right here is the people. So when he tried to go into this people that were assembled there, the disciples wouldn't let him. So they're like, no, dude, do not go in there. It would be a bad idea. They were already looking for you. Also, some of the Asiarchs who were friends of his sent to him and repeatedly urged him not to venture into the theater. Asiarchs were rulers of the Asia province, the different parts of it. And so they would have been at Ephesus from time to time to help make policies, not just simply for Ephesus, but for all of Asia. And so Paul has cultivated a relationship with at least two or more of these Asiarchs. And these guys get wind that Paul was thinking about going in there and going, no, 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 no. Do not do that. This is a mob. They will kill you. Don't risk it. Verse number 32. So then, you got a picture in the theater. Remember, 25,000 seats. And then, you know, down in the bottom is where they're trying to lead the meeting. So the guy that started this all is no doubt down there really keeping the crowd pumped up. But the local official leader for this assembly is going to show up pretty quick here. So anyway, everything's going on in the crowd. So then some were shouting one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion. The majority didn't even know for what reason they'd come together. Now, isn't that just the way a mob works? You know, we see things happen here in our country from time to time. Sometimes after a big win for a ball team, a sports team, they'll be just partying through the streets. The next thing you know, they're breaking windows open and stealing stuff. And they totally forgot what the whole point was.
Or they're mad at each other's teams.
Yeah. Or the things that happened with the Black Lives Movement thing that started happening out in the Northwest and other places. At first, you know, they were mad about a very specific thing, and then pretty soon it took a life on its own, and they didn't even know why they were there. They were just mad. And that's unfortunately what happens when you've got a mob going. It becomes an animal of its own. And so that's what's happened here. A lot of the people are like, hey, they're all going to the theater for something. What is it? Well, I don't know, but we need to get there and take care of business. Okay? And so they're all there, yelling back and forth at each other. Verse 33. Some of the crowd concluded it was Alexander, since the Jews had put him forward, and having motioned with his hand, Alexander was intending to make a defense to the assembly. So this guy named Alexander jumps up because he wants to try to address the crowd, because that's the point of getting together in this theater for policy meetings, for democratic interaction, is people make speeches and try to talk about the situation. It says here he was intending to make a defense to the assembly. The word for defense there is that apology word. It's not saying I'm sorry about something, it's let me tell you what the deal is. So he stands up and he's trying to get everybody's attention to talk. Now, you might think this is the era before PA systems. How in the world would 25,000 people in this theater hear what one guy's saying? Acoustics. Remember, this is a theater building. They have sloped seating areas, and then they've got at the bottom of this semicircle sloped seating area, they've got a, it's a building, it's a long building that forms the stage. And so anything that's said down here at the bottom goes out really well into the auditorium. They could also use like little megaphones to do things, and it would be very effective. So this guy is probably down there trying to use a megaphone or something to get everybody calmed down and explain to them what's happening. Basically to say, he hasn't done anything wrong. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, a single outcry arose from them all as they shouted for 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Now, why would they be upset that a Jew was trying to address them?
Different religion.
A different religion. Do Jews accept Artemis?
No.
No. Jews have one God. And that God does not have any images. And everybody knew that. Everybody understood that about Jewish people. The Jewish religion was a a religion with special protections in the Roman Empire. They had special dispensations for all sorts of things. Like, you couldn't make them work on Sunday. You could not, not Sunday, Sabbath day. Saturday.
Like the Amish kind of.
Like the Amish. It had special dispensations. You couldn't force them to serve in the army. They couldn't be drafted. There could be special Jewish units, but they couldn't be forced into it. They couldn't be taken to court on Sabbath day. They couldn't even be taken into court after a certain time on Friday afternoon. And this is the one that probably ticked a lot of people off. They always took the seventh year off, and they didn't have to pay taxes to Rome during that seventh year. They were tax immune in the year that they took off from their work. And so everybody knew about Jews, and these guys are not happy because they're proponents of Artemis. And so can you imagine that? 2 hours chanting that in this auditorium. Now finally, somebody with some official power shows up. Verse 35. After quieting the crowd, the town clerk. So here's one of the guys that works full time for the government structure of Ephesus and Asia. He's actually a scribe. So he's probably the one that keeps the minutes of these meetings. He's the one that makes sure all the new policies get posted, because these guys were big into paperwork. When they adopted new policies, and this was true not just at Ephesus, this was true all over the Greek and Roman world. When you adopted a new policy, it was written out typically on a bronze tablet. Good, clear lettering. And it was posted in a public place so that everybody could go there and read what the rules were. Literacy was very high in the ancient world. So this guy who's involved in making sure policies are made clear, he said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there after all who does not know that the city of Ephesus of the Ephesians is guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of the image which fell from heaven?" Did you hear that? See, that goes back to the theory then that there was something about something falling from the sky that started this whole Artemis cult. It probably even selected where they put the temple. I would guess that the temple was built right on top of the crater where that meteorite came down. But that's just guessing. All right, so he says, "Hey, everybody in the world knows that Ephesus is where the image of Artemis fell, and that we're the guardians of that image. So, since these are undeniable facts, you ought to keep calm and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of our goddess." So just in the time that they've spent there, this is what they've discovered. This guy in particular. He's found out that these guys that they grabbed and brought here, they haven't gone in and stolen anything out of any of the temples. And they haven't been talking down, you know, specifically about Artemis. Yeah, Paul has probably said some things about, you know, idols are just things. But you know, some of the worshipers of Artemis would probably agree with that. They'd probably say, "Well, that's true. The real Artemis is in heaven. We've got an image of her that was specially given to us." So they can't really bring any charges against these guys. Not really. So then, If Demetrius and the craftsmen who are with him have a complaint against any man, the courts are in session, the proconsuls are available, let them bring charges against one another. So they've got a very tight legal system. If you want to bring somebody to court and sue them for damages, they have a system for that. You got to do the paperwork, get your lawyer to go after their lawyer, and all of that stuff. Same thing that we've got today. And so that's what this guy says, is look, if this is all about money, with, you know, these guys feel like they're losing money because of stuff that Paul has done, there's the court system right across the street. Go do it. But if you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in the lawful assembly. Now, you see that phrase right there is, it's actually regular gathering of the people. And this time, the word assembly right there, you actually might have a footnote for this. It depends. That's actually the word where we get our word church from. Ecclesia. And it means the called out ones. And it basically means that when the regular meeting has been called, you show up. And you make your voice heard. And you take your vote. That's what they thought of as the regular assembly. And it was probably on a regular schedule. I don't know if it was weekly or monthly or three times or four times a year. Whatever it was, this is not one of those meetings. And so he says, look, guys, if you've got other problems, save it for our regular get-together. And then finally, he said this, verse 40. For indeed, we are in danger of being accused of a riot in connection with today's events, since there is no real cause for it. And in this connection, we will be unable to account for this disorderly gathering. The Romans were sticklers for peacefulness. And this whole area is a Roman province. And so the Roman authorities, which typically you'd have like a civilian head, a prefect, but then he would have control of Roman military that acted as police persons, as well as civilian people that could act as police persons. So if the local people couldn't keep things under control, the Romans would step in and make it happen. And if it was repeatedly out of control, the Romans would actually fire the people that had been locally voted in. We actually see that threat in the story about Jesus. In one of the council meetings, the Sanhedrin people got together and were talking about Jesus having all these people following him and that everything was kind of out of control. And basically, if we do not get this under control, the Romans will come and take our place away from us. So they figured that they'd get fired from being, you know, in charge of the area. And the Romans would do that from time to time. If they felt that a high priest couldn't keep the population in control, they'd fire him and put somebody else in control. That's just the way the Romans worked. All right, comments, questions now. All right, so they're worried the Romans are going to come down on them if they don't get this illegal assembly dismissed. And that seems to have worked. That seems to have appeased them. And it says, after saying this, he dismissed the assembly. And so everyone went back to their homes. Now, do you think those guys, the tradesmen, do you think that they were perfectly fine with everything? No. You know that they're trying to figure out a way that they can get even with Paul still. Which is why we see the same thing happen again that always happens with Paul. When he goes into a new place, what's the first place that he takes the gospel? To the Jews in the synagogue, right? Once he saturates that area, he then spreads out to the Gentiles that are interested. But what happens if suddenly there seems to be all this negative attention to Paul? What does he do at that point?
He stomps his feet and leaves.
Yeah, he leaves. He gets the dust off his feet or off his clothes and says, I'm done here. I'm moving on. I've given you as much as I can give, and I'm going somewhere else. And that's exactly what he does. So he'd already been planning to leave at Pentecost. We don't know how far away that was time-wise, but he'd already had a schedule to leave within a matter of weeks or months. So he just moves that itinerary date up. So chapter 20, after the uproar had ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and when he'd exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he left to go to Macedonia. So remember, that's up here. It's across the north part of this Aegean Sea. So he basically leaves Ephesus and just follows the Roman road up through a couple of the other seven cities. And he goes to the city of Troas, which has a port that serves as the takeoff point across the north part of that sea. But he doesn't jump on the boat right away, because apparently there were some prearranged meetings at Troas. How do we know that? You got your Bible. You can go to 2 Corinthians 2. Now, Paul writes 2 Corinthians after he's made his way through Macedonia and he's got down into the area by Corinth. It's a follow-up letter to visiting Corinth. And in this letter, he tells about how he left Ephesus and went to Troas next. So 2 Corinthians 2:12. Now, when I came to Troas for the gospel of Christ, and when a door was opened for me in the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit, not finding Titus my brother. So apparently, he had some prearranged meeting with Titus, that he'd sent Titus ahead. But apparently he told him, hey, when you get done doing all this pre-stuff for me, meet me at Troas and we'll do some evangelistic work there before we go on to Macedonia. Well, Paul gets to Troas and he's there for a while and things are going good, but he keeps thinking, why isn't Titus here? What's the problem? Where's Titus? He's not meeting me like he was supposed to meet me. And I'm a little bit early. And so eventually, he says right here, taking my leave of them, I went on to Macedonia. So he figures, if Titus doesn't get to me, I'll just track him down myself. So he takes the ship and goes across to Macedonia. And we already know there's several cities here that he started the churches in. And so he has no problem checking out all these places. Titus was at one of them. So Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, those are all the places that he would have wanted to check in again with. So it says here, this is Acts 20 again. So he left to go to Macedonia. Verse 2, when he had gone through those districts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece.
Verse 2.
In Acts 20. I went back to Acts 20, sorry. Sorry about the bouncing, but I just wanted you to see that Paul writes about what he did with a little bit more detail elsewhere. Now, in just one verse there, that's a lot of territory covered. I mean, all of this area here is mentioned, and then he's down here in Achaia. But there's something that we find out in the book of Romans that he actually wrote right around this same time as well. And that is that he had taken the gospel as far as Illyricum. Now, we don't have Illyricum anymore. It's up here along the coast, north of Macedonia. It actually touches Macedonia, right around here. See the heel of the boot of Italy? Well, if you go northeast from there, that's where Macedonia and Illyricum touch. And there was a great big major city there, right on the border. This is all Albania now, I think. We have no place in the book of Acts telling us when he ended up being at Illyricum. And so the best possible time that he could have done it was on this little trip right here. Because he would have had plenty of time to do this. Go through Macedonia and then jump on the Roman road out of Berea, which goes up this direction past this lake right here, and then eventually terminates right here at the borderland, at that big city. And so that's probably when he did it, was on this trip. And then once he got done there, he could have either caught a boat and come down to Corinth, or he could have just followed the Roman road that goes along the coast and eventually goes to Corinth. Either one would have worked. But he covers a lot of territory during this late spring, summer, early fall. That's all this area right here that he covers until he finally arrives at Corinth, just like his original schedule. Because remember, when he wrote 1 Corinthians, he says, I think I'll probably spend the winter with you. So he gets to Corinth in time to spend, you know, the 3 months of winter with the people at Corinth and preach and teach there. So verse number 3 of Acts 20. There he spent 3 months. And at the end of winter, something happens here. First of all, in the winter months, only the most absolute, no choice, must happen, have to happen sailing gets done. Because the weather is just not all that great in the eastern Mediterranean during the winter months. So you usually would start sailing again, I think it was after Passover time. So call it end of March, early April. So he decides that he's going to jump on a boat near Corinth and head back, probably to Jerusalem first, and then go up to Antioch and report in there. And then his goal is to take his next trip out to Rome. We know that. He told us that elsewhere. But as he's making the arrangements to get on a very specific boat that's heading to Syria, which this is all Syria here at this time. This is what we're told. Acts 20, verse 3. There he spent 3 months, and when a plot was formed against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. Can I speculate with you a little bit on this?
Throw him in a drink.
That's exactly what I think happened, is that somehow they got wind. I don't know if the Holy Spirit revealed it to him, or if somebody in the crew told him, but somehow there was some whispering going on that somewhere on the boat ride, Paul was going overboard. And he weren't coming back again to cause any more trouble. And so when he gets wind of that, he changes his plans at the last minute. Now, I think he probably got on a different ship, because there is no real good direct road that goes from Corinth up along this coast to Macedonia. There's a great big mountain range right through here. Mount Olympus is in that mountain range. Okay? So, I think he might have just switched to a different boat and took a ride up to maybe Amphipolis or Thessalonica or someplace up there and jumped off and checked in with all the other churches one more time. And there's something else he's doing here. He's doing one more collection for the poor people in Judea. Because remember, that's one of the things that we saw in the book of 1 Corinthians, is that there is this perennial problem in Judea that Jewish people who accept Jesus as Messiah get kicked out of the synagogues. And the synagogues were where all the social support structure was formed. So if you got kicked out of the synagogue and you were like a poor widow, you got no more assistance from the synagogue financially. If you were a poor widow trying to raise kids, orphans, you know, because dad's not around anymore, and you got kicked out of the synagogue, your kids were in danger of starving to death or, worse yet, being sold into slavery, and you yourself being sold into slavery. If you were a poor person of any type, you know, you were financially on the brink, and you needed assistance, but you'd been kicked out of the synagogue, they were not going to help you. So there were a whole bunch of Jewish Christians that had gotten kicked out of synagogues all over Judea. And Paul was aware of this. It had been going on for years. And so he had agreed with the leadership in Judea, within the church, I'm going to ask the Gentile believers everywhere that I go to chip in some support money to help these people out. Seems pretty good idea, right? And so he is checking in with all these different churches saying, okay, where's the support money? Is it ready to go? Are the people that you're sending with it, are they ready to go? So that's why we see so many names listed next in Acts chapter 20, verse 4. He was accompanied by Sopater of Berea. That's one of the cities up here in Macedonia, the son of Pyrrhus, and Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians. That's up here. And Gaius of Derbe. That's actually over here. Timothy and Tychicus, they're from over here as well. And Trophimus of Asia, that's this region. And so these guys, at least some of them, are probably representatives of their home church or the home area that they're from, making sure that the money is properly used once it arrives in Jerusalem. They're being held accountable for that. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment, how much money must they be carrying with them? They've been collecting money on this missionary trip for 4 years. 5 years in some places.
And they haven't sent any of it back.
And none of it has been sent back specifically yet. Remember when Paul was writing in the Corinthian letter, he said, if you want to send it on with somebody, that's fine. But if you want to send it with me, that's fine too.
Wow. That's not helping the people that need it.
Well, yeah, it's not getting back there as quickly. But he's probably intending to refresh the treasury that's already there. Because this has been happening before. Some of the Gentile churches up here in Antioch have been sending money down. This is one of the reasons, and I will remind you of it when we get to it. When Paul gets back at the end of this journey to Jerusalem, he gets involved in another riot, and he gets arrested, even though it's not his fault. And then he gets detained by the Romans, even though they didn't really have a reason to detain him, other than the fact that the Jews were still ticked and they were trying to be nice to the Jewish leadership. The Roman prefect that keeps him in detention, it specifically says in our sacred text that Roman prefect was hoping that Paul would give him money in order to release him. Because he probably knew this guy just arrived in town with a ton of silver and gold. And I need a cut of that. I'd like a cut of that. So, the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? Everybody has a handout somewhere there. Even for funds that are supposed to be used for benevolent purposes. You know, it's ridiculous. We actually have to check benevolent societies to see how much of the money you donate to them actually goes to the thing they're saying. And unfortunately, there's a lot of them. It's less than 50% actually goes to the thing that they're claiming that they're trying to help out.
Sometimes that's because they're bad at business.
Yeah, and so I think a lot of times it's because they're bad at business. But other times we find out too late that it's being embezzled. But you just got to do what you can do. So anyway, that's why those names are there, I think, in part. And so they are sent across in their own little group to Troas. Right here it says that these had gone on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas. Notice that it's us again. Luke has rejoined the party because he wants to go to the Holy Land. And here's my reason why I think he wants to go to the Holy Land. He wants to interview people about the gospel story. He wants to talk to eyewitnesses. Why do I think that? Because that's what he says in the book of Luke at the very beginning. When he's writing to this guy named Theophilus, we don't know who that is, he basically says, all those things that we were taught, all those things that we heard about, I have investigated them, and now I'm writing them to you in a structured order. So Luke, I think, is on this boat ride, this trip, because he wants to go where it all started. He's a Gentile, but he is a man that loves the Lord, and he wants to share that story with other people. So verse 6 is where we'll pick up next week. We sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. So they will leave Philippi in April, I think, in order to start on this last journey. And Paul is trying his best to get to Jerusalem before Pentecost. And I think the reason might be something we could appreciate. Pentecost will be the 25th anniversary of the start of the church. And quarter century marks were important in that culture as well. 25, 50, 75, 100, all of those were pretty big deals. So I think he's actually trying to get there for the 25th anniversary. But he's going to end up being arrested instead. But that's a bigger story. Okay, comments, questions? Yeah, Rita.
I just wondered, you know, talk about Luke being a doctor. What did that entail at this time?
Yeah, doctors back at this time were not experts in microbiology because they didn't know about microbiology. Most of the doctoring they did was long time passed down traditions of trial and error. So they would know things like the bark off of willow trees could take care of aches and pains. They knew that.
And they were herbalists.
Well, they were herbalists, yeah. They knew that the juice of a poppy would make you sleepy and could take away pain that way. They had done trial and error for many hundreds of years of what herbs would work, and they also knew basic anatomy. so that they knew how to set bones and do minor surgeries by our standard. Caesareans actually started back at this time. They started first amongst vets, trying to save very valuable animals, but pretty quick they figured out that they could do that with people. In fact, it got its name Caesarian because the guy named Caesar was delivered that way. Okay? And a lot of the doctors also work with military, because military needs patching up of their wounded. And so they got a lot of practices that way as well. So they knew a lot of stuff about anatomy. They knew a lot of stuff about basic observances of symptoms and how they could be resolved with treatments. But they were guessing a lot of the stuff. I mean, at this time, they thought the air of an area could cause disease. And we're not talking about like microbiology floating around. They were just saying if this area is low and you've got this type of fog that comes from time to time, you can end up with certain diseases. Some of it they might have guessed fairly accurately. You know, malaria does happen around swamps. But they didn't know all the ins and outs. So Luke would have studied a ton of those writings and would have practiced under senior doctors and then carried out his. We see one of his prescriptions passed on through Paul. Apparently Timothy had some sort of stomach problem, Paul said, Timothy, you need to quit drinking only water and take a little wine for your stomach's sake. That was a very common treatment for what we would refer to as gallstones. Don't know if it would work. I know vinegar is supposed to be something that people will take in order to fight that. And so a lot of their wines had a high acid content. And so it might have been that. But anyway, that's the type of doctor he was. Anything else?
Okay. Only just something interesting, because I like plants, so I looked up Artemisia.
Artemisia.
Which is apparently named after Artemis.
It is.
Which is of the family Asteroidaceae.
Oh, an asteroid. That's interesting. I wonder if it is tied in. That would kind of be interesting. Aster, of course, is star in Greek. And so an asteroid is, you know, a falling star.
Uh-huh.
So
I thought it was kind of cool.
It might be very much related into the story of Artemis. Fair warning, next Wednesday we will have class, but the Wednesday after that we won't. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Let me verify on that again.
That's correct.
Okay, because we'll be in Israel. So I'm not coming back for Wednesday night Bible study. It's too long of a trip. So anyway, think about us 2 weeks from tonight. Just trying to remember where we'll be. Somewhere in Galilee.
Where's that?
It's way off the map over here. It's right there. Long ways off. Okay. Let's pray and head out and live for Christ. Father, we thank you for the night we got to spend looking at Dr. Luke's writings and for the work that Paul and the others were doing. And we're thankful, Lord, that no matter what happened, the gospel didn't get stopped. It just kept moving on to the next place. And more people were able to embrace it. Help us to take a lesson from that, to just keep with Jesus and try to share it with whoever is willing to listen and just to keep on moving on with it. And now help us to have a great rest of this week and a great Lord's Day that's coming up. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.